So if you look at industrialization, it took the UK 200 years to industrialize. It took the US 100 and it took China 50. So Saudi can do it in 25. It's sort of like Moore's law. It keeps halving. Technology that's emerging that will become very important is quantum computing. That will, you know, I mean, a quantum computer of this size in the future will have all the processing power of every computer on the planet that exists today. And what that means for encryption and other areas, it's a guess, but it's an area that you have to be focused on. So a friend of mine, and I didn't study technology. I think before we started this, I said I used to price derivatives off an HP calculator. So my first Lotus 1-2-3 program was in 1992, my first desktop. But anyway, a friend of mine was a very clever electrical engineer, and he was building a computer chip in 1992 to go into a pacemaker. Mm-hmm. And I said, what does it do? And he said, well, it studies the pattern of your heart cardiac rhythms, and it can predict when you're about to have a heart attack and therefore defibrillate you. So this is like so super advanced at the time, and also a great medical solution for people who can now drive cars with pacemakers, because before you'd be driving your car, you'd have a heart attack, pass out, hit a telegraph pole and wake up. So now you don't have the heart attack and you can pull over. So I said to him straight away, do you think this program, this neural network program, if it can study patterns and teach itself, could it study the pattern of a financial instrument and forecast it? I first imagined becoming a CEO, ironically, when I was coaching a couple of rugby teams. I know I'm Australian, sports fanatic. And it was taking a team that actually wasn't performing very well and finding a way to coach them into believing in themselves and winning and beating the competition. When I thought about the attributes and elements behind that for sporting teams, not just the one I was coaching, but famous examples of great sporting teams, I started thinking, well, maybe CEOs should kind of be like that, you know, rather than being disciplinarians or sort of risk averse. You know, many CEOs I'd worked with, they're always terrified of the mistakes people would make and what the regulator would think. So I started thinking about how to build cultures within the financial sector that created ambition and innovation.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Measures podcast. My name is Ismail Khoyatlar, and with me today, I have Tony Cripps, CEO of Saab Bank. Thank you so much for being here today,
welcome.
Tony.
Nice welcome.
Tony was also previously the CEO of HSBC Singapore and has spent his career in banking and is here with us today to talk about the growth of the banking landscape and specifically also financial innovation within the kingdom and Saab's role within all of that. So just to get started, maybe, Tony, I know you've been here for 5 or 6 years now in the kingdom. 5 years. Congratulations. Would love to hear from you how the banking landscape has evolved within that time and how you've seen yourself and Saab grow within that space as well.
Sure. It's been fascinating. So going back 5 years, when I thought about the Middle East and Saudi in particular, it seemed logical given the geopolitics that was happening and the fundamentals of the region, the demographics. There were so many things that were pointing to a positive future that was logical that the region was going to prosper and be the focus of attention for countries outside looking to come in and do business. And then the vision was created around that time, and so there was a plan. And wherever I've worked in the world, not surprisingly, where countries, regions have plans that are very clear and very focused, there's a tendency for things to work out pretty well. So knowing all that, coming into the kingdom, we just merged two large banks, and it was getting those two banks into a position where they could take advantage of the growth. The growth from the vision first for the banking sector came through the retail side of the business, so through mortgages, because there was an ambition to take home ownership from below 50% to 70%. Unfortunately, in the beginning, we weren't ready for that because we were doing a merger. But the other banks in the kingdom, two largest banks in particular, were growing their lending to the mortgage sector incredibly quickly. And it was in, and it was also very, very profitable, the way the subsidies worked. So that drove the banking sector growth predominantly in the first 2 years. For the sector, what's emerged in the last 2 or 3 years is, because part of the vision is so much around infrastructure, the large giga projects people are aware of, like NEOM and Red Sea, Alula and others, and the supply chain that goes through that to build, you know, roads, energy infrastructure, hotels, all of this stuff that needs to get built, stadiums for the World Cup football, is driving the corporate sector now in a way that's growing now faster than the retail sector. So the banking system's had a wonderful period of 5 years, first retail and now more corporate, but retail is still also growing, you know, fairly strongly, because home ownership is still, you know, got to get from 63 to 70 in terms of ambition. For Saab, when we put the two banks together, we built a five-year plan, which was around growing our client base, growing our lending, underpinned by a large investment in technology to provide access. And we don't have 1,000 branches, we've got 100. So if we're going to access clients, we're going to do it digitally as best we can. That's been highly successful. We invested and focused on our culture, and that that was around innovation and mindset. And so here we sit on the fifth floor in our new building in the innovation lab. We also, underpinning the growth strategy was ESG, making sure that we were best in class when it came to governance, our social commitments, and of course, sustainable finance is one of the big sectors of opportunity. So we've managed to more than double up profitability in the last 4 years. We've become much more efficient. Actually, we've got the same number of people that we had 5 years ago, but we've 2.5 times our profit. Our links to the international markets, which I know we'll get onto, are hugely important as well, now that more companies are coming into Saudi.
And I think that lends itself nicely to the subsequent question of, how would you compare this growth you've had across time? So what has it looked like previously, and then across, you know, spatial global awareness? So what have the other markets looked like?
If you think about taking the profit of a large bank up 2.5 times in 4 years, that's not very common. So, and it was only possible, obviously, because of the opportunities that existed in growing the balance sheet and the way in which the market's opening up to international connectivity, both on the corporate side, but more now also on the retail side. But we've got 1.6 million customers on our retail franchise, and 40% of them are expats. So there's a very large connectivity both on retail and corporate. On the corporate side, obviously the RHQ strategy is attracting companies, the multinationals that come in to do infrastructure, the EPC contractors, et cetera, the technology companies, the large ones that are setting up data centers. We bank 80 to 85% of all the companies that come in bank with Saab. So we have a great brand. But yeah, that kind of growth is very rare anywhere. To look at the sector itself, so the balance sheet growth of Saab has been about 15% compound over the last 5 years. That's fast. And there have been questions on how quickly can that keep going, because the banking system needs to keep raising capital. It needs to grow its deposit base. And so far, so good. It's happening. And the capital markets are opening up to Saudi issuance, both on the bank side, but also on the sovereign side. So we think the growth can continue despite the current volatility, which raises questions around the oil price and other questions as well.
And continuing on that forward-looking trend, what changes do you see coming, if any? Are there underserved, untapped markets here that you think, both on the corporate and retail side, that could continue to grow? Do you see a pause?
So the large corporate space, which we have traditionally played in as a bank that's been here for 70 years, that's natural for us, and that will continue, and there's strong economic underpinnings around that. As part of the vision was focused on the SME market. If you look at developed markets, 70% of the jobs that exist in developed economies come from the SME sector, countries like Australia, where I'm from. So at the moment, the sector currently probably represents about 8, maybe 10% of the economy overall in the financing in the banking sector. The ambition is to grow that to 25, 30, 40%, and so that's an area that we've also now focused on. It's a small part of our business, but for instance, we used to maybe 50 or 100 new clients a month in that sector. Now it can be up to 1,000 new clients a month. So we think that's an important part of the banking system that needs to develop and is developing, and it will be a strong employer across multiple sectors. And Saudi's always been famous for energy exports and Aramco, et cetera. But the great thing about SME is you'll get multiple sectors that can employ different talents and diverse talents within Saudi economy.
And then to get into some of the more exciting stuff like innovation, and before we talk about innovation in Saudi, for example, I know you've spent a long career in banking and in innovation as well. If you could tell us a little bit about your background there and how it inspires you today.
So a friend of mine, and I didn't study technology. I think before we started this, I said I used to price derivatives off an HP calculator. So my first Lotus 1-2-3 program was in 1992, my first desktop. But anyway, a friend of mine was a very clever electrical engineer, and he was building a computer chip in 1992 to go into a pacemaker. Mm-hmm. And I said, what does it do? And he said, well, it studies the pattern of your heart cardiac rhythms, and it can predict when you're about to have a heart attack and therefore defibrillate you. So this is like so super advanced at the time, and also a great medical solution for people who can now drive cars with pacemakers, because before you'd be driving your car, you'd have a heart attack, pass out, hit a telegraph pole and wake up. So now you don't have the heart attack and you can pull over. So I said to him straight away, do you think this program, this neural network program, if it can study patterns and teach itself, could it study the pattern of a financial instrument and forecast it? And he said, well, maybe. So I was lucky enough to be given money by HSBC back then, quite a lot of money actually, to study at the University of Sydney with the engineering department. And we proved that the program could forecast the Australian dollar, and it ended up being a piece of academic research. But that started my love affair with technology, because it gave me an edge in trading. And in trading, you're always looking for some sort of advantage. So I got involved using advanced technology for trading. Then I was involved in the late 90s and early 2000s with automating the trading world, and taking the banking services onto the internet for the first time. And it changed completely trading rooms all around the world. They used to be loud places, people screaming and shouting. Now they were quiet because the machines did all of the work and trades were just processed. And now, of course, I think nearly half of all of the trading on the New York Stock Exchange is just computers, just people watching computers do stuff. So yeah, technology has always been key. So in thinking about how you grow a bank, innovation has to be part of the core of your strategy. I mean, there's better services for customers, more efficient ways of accessing your services, but also you become much more productive as you automate within the processing. I mean, an example is we just put a trade platform in trade finance, and we're the biggest trade finance bank in Saudi. We have about 24% market share. So the way in which those trades get processed, someone buys some goods from overseas and you have to exchange paper. You know, here's the goods and here's the financing and whatever. And the exchange of papers can take days. So we've just implemented a system where that now happens digitally and it takes seconds. So all of a sudden, all the people that were processing papers are now free to do much more value-added jobs and service customers better. It takes the risk profile as well of manual processing down, so you get less mistakes, cost of doing business is lower.
I think that's one misconception people have, is that technology will render them obsolete, but there is a world where the technology actually makes your job more enjoyable because it's doing sort of the the more manual labor for you.
It enhances what you do. Again, in the early 2000s, long before robotics was ever even a word, we built a platform that just assigned customers an identity and a profile against a list of services that we provided within the bank. And so it made it really easy for the people that were talking to the customers on the phone to go, well, here's this customer, and we know what the profile is, and therefore they're going to be interested in these products. And so it made the whole conversation more efficient. It will print out term sheets so that the legal documentation was all sort of, I mean, it was just, it wasn't cool. We didn't know what to call it, but we didn't call it robotics. Now that's sort of robotics.
Yeah.
Computers will assign different risk profiles to clients for investment strategies, et cetera. But yeah, technology is a great tool to enhance services. And to your point, when we automated the foreign exchange business for HSBC globally, we didn't end up with less people because those same people, the 500 people that we employed in foreign exchange, became much better salespeople with their customers because they didn't consume all their time with deal input. It was having conversations. Technology doesn't mean less jobs. It changes jobs. And I can tell you, I'm not getting in an aeroplane without a pilot. But even though it's on autopilot, I need a bus.
And all right, then let's talk a little bit about Saudi and today and financial innovation here. I mean, to your point, for example, underwriting is a hot topic right now. B2B in general is something that we've seen skyrocketing. Tell me a little bit about the trends you're seeing, what you're excited about.
So SAMA's advanced in a way that the Monetary Authority Singapore, when I was there for 4 years, was very focused on innovation in the banking sector and built a sandbox, they called it, which allowed fintechs and banks to play together in the sandbox, which is ring-fenced outside the infrastructure of the national economy. And so you do these experiments, and if they work, then you can introduce them into the banking system. And it's around payments automation, a blockchain for instantaneous settlement, tokenized assets is another area of interest. I mean, imagine if you could tokenize your house, for instance. You could day trade it. You could sell it in the morning, buy it back in the afternoon, as opposed to, you know, hiring a broker and doing all that stuff. So tokenized assets is really also a strong area. AI, which has become a buzzword, but it's been around for 30 years. And how that helps in real use cases. And an example is we've just implemented an AI program that has all of our regulatory requirements in the database. And you can just ask it a question about, can you tell me about the regulation association with X, Y, and Z? In the past, you have to get someone to go through the index of information, find the regulation, whatever. It could take hours. And now it just comes back in a second. So that's an example of a tool that helps our legal people and our compliance people. Our risk people are saying we have predictive modeling around risk given different economic scenarios. So AI is very important. Technology that's emerging that will become very important is quantum computing. That will, a quantum computer of this size in the future will have all the processing power of every computer on the planet that exists today. And what that means for encryption and other areas, it's a guess, but it's an area that you have to be focused on. It's going to change the world.
And in a previous interview, you said that technology is an opportunity and also a challenge for banks. Could you expand on what you meant by that?
Yeah, so the opportunities, we've just spoken about, they're great for customer service, better for bank staff, make their lives easier in how they function, lower risk, enhance brand. The risks for the banks are that the introduction of all new technology creates some sort of risks that you have to analyze. And banks aren't technology companies. They're heavily regulated. And in most jurisdictions, when they make mistakes, it's pretty bad. Like if your banking services go out, your ATM machines crash or something, the regulators don't like it and your customers don't like it. So you have to be quite cautious So banks are often accused of not being agile, of being too slow, and, you know, traditionally this is always the criticism. So to help get around that, this is why we create the innovation floor, to allow people to sit outside that framework and experiment. And then when we're sure that there's a value add there and we've played in the sandbox, then we can test and bring it into the traditional banking service.
Are you seeing, outside of, you know, getting around the regulatory framework and testing things out in the sandbox, challenges for the adoption of financial technologies, whether that's within the bank or what you see your customers struggling with?
No, I think the adoption curve is good. It's very well supported and encouraged in Saudi by the central bank and by the ministries. So I think progress is really good, actually. The FinTech conference here has gone from nothing to the biggest in the world. And for ourselves, our engagement with the FinTech sector itself, the inbound interest now is growing exponentially. FinTechs from around the world coming into Saudi. It's quite phenomenal.
What would you advise international companies who want to land in Saudi?
Well, first, they should come straight to Saab. No, you need, in any new country you enter, you obviously need partners. Right. So yeah, of course, you need a strong banking partner, of course. But it's also important that you connect to the ecosystem of the sector. So FinTech, there's a very good ecosystem now of FinTechs who collaborate with themselves. I mean, we have this floor, obviously, in the bank where we're bringing FinTechs in. Mm-hmm. They're working together on different projects for us. But connecting to the ecosystem is really important for incumbents from other places coming in to learn about Saudi. And potentially joint ventures where the local players will have the landscape knowledge to make the best use of the technology that's being introduced.
Makes sense. And since we're touching on the innovation floor as well, could you tell us a little bit about Saab's mandate in terms of financial innovation and what you see the floor's role being there?
Yeah. So at the beginning of the strategy, technology was important. It was a key part of the five-year plan. And so I asked our board for some money to invest in fintechs. And they said, well, why do you want to do that? And I said, well, two reasons. It creates a culture within the institution that changes the mindset around innovation. So getting away from that conservative regulatory framework into, oh, we're dealing with a fintech from here on payments or tokenized assets. So it helps change the culture where your staff begin to believe that you're really interested in experimentation and innovation. And that culture permeates beyond technology into other parts of the bank, of course. So that was the first reason. Second was it introduces us to new technologies that we might not get access to if we didn't engage and invest in the fintech itself. Mm-hmm. And so we've invested in companies where we have strategic interest in their solutions. We also invested in a venture capital fund because they themselves have interests across many, many sectors, areas within fintech, payments, and other areas. And that helped us get engaged with the ecosystem that we otherwise wouldn't have had a chance to meet. So in those two areas, it's been highly successful. We have invested and found great solutions from different providers, and we built this floor. As I said, we've got fintech companies just next door doing things like risk modeling experimentation using virtual quantum. It's not actually quantum, but it's simulating quantum capability within the modeling and many other areas. So we're really proud of our support for the fintech sector, and it's selfish. I mean, it helps us grow the business.
No, but there's a presumption that, you know, fintechs and incumbents banks are naturally pitted against each other.
No, I learned this, said when I was in charge of technology 25 years ago in HSBC. Different fintech solutions or take digital banks. They potentially go after a customer group that you may not be interested in. It could be micro lending to sort of high risk parts of the economy, which traditional banks probably would just stay away from. So if that's their business model and that's their focus, and you become the back end of their processing, then it's a symbiotic relationship that you're getting new customer flows that you wouldn't otherwise get. So you have a partnership with that particular provider. And that includes for us digital banks. They will want our services at the back end, either processing or products that they haven't developed themselves, and regulatory certainty around different things. So it's not a competition. I mean, yeah, some areas might provide competition, but in most cases, it allows a traditional bank to provide better service.
And this, I mean, goes beyond fintech, right? Because if you take the assumption that fintech is just empowering financial technology, you could use this in any sector. And I mean, there's so many sectors under the vision that need improving.
Yeah, well, the concept of embedded finance, again, was around 25 years ago. And I was having conversations with large companies, like take a back-end processing company like SAP. They have the back office software and for procurement and other areas. And so engaging with a company like that and embedding financial services within their platform was something that was an idea 20 years ago and didn't really happen because the business model couldn't be agreed. But now it's happened. So now instead of, you know, a big technology company becoming a bank and getting a license and all of that that comes with that, they just simply provide those banking services and use a traditional bank to provide the services white labeled into their own platform. So that's now happening. And that's a big change.
And that's an example of success, right? I'm wondering what else looks like success to you, or how do you sort of evade, we've had in the kingdom across sectors, this notion of a ton of MOUs being signed and then the project, you know, you never hear from it again after that. So how do you ensure that these partnerships are not just symbolic, but actually executed on?
So when we sign an MOU and a commitment, we've already decided on the strategy and the execution plan and have the resources to go after the opportunity. An example was we signed an MOU with HSBC, Saab signed an MOU, and it was around bringing HSBC's retail banking services into the kingdom to enhance what Saab already did. So one example of that was HSBC 20 years ago was one of the first banks in the world that allowed you to connect your accounts across countries and have all of your financial position with the bank in multiple countries in one place and allowed you to move money between those countries instantly. And there was no such thing as instant payments back then. So it was quite unique. And for someone like me who's lived in, you know, 10 countries, it's quite useful. So that's what we connected Saab to HSBC. So now if you have a Saab bank account and an HSBC bank account in Singapore or Australia or New York or whatever, you can do that. You can connect the accounts and no one else can do that. So that MOU was signed and then something was done. So that's how we think about it ourselves. On the project side and the ambitions, maybe there are some examples of things that perhaps are being put on hold, but that's a function of other priorities that come around. I mean, if I think about since I've been here, the value of projects estimated to be completed over the next decade or so has gone from 800 billion to 1.4 trillion or something. So the amount of ambition has gone up. So things get reprioritized. Saudi's won Expo since I've been here. There's a ton of work around that. The Football World Cup, you know, have to build dozens of stadiums or something. So there's plenty of work to go around. Even if some MOUs are just pushed back a little bit, that doesn't mean that the growth ambition has minimized or.
That's fair. And the using this long-term outlook as well, you've been here for 5 years now. You know, the focus in 2020 was firmly towards Vision 2030. Now people have started preemptively looking towards Vision 2040. So learning from the past 5 years, what does the next 10, 15 look like for you?
Yeah, so when I was in China a couple of years ago talking to our client base in China on the HSBC side and just describing the opportunity that the Chinese companies had to come into Saudi. I explained to them or asked them to think back to China in the 1990s. When I first started visiting China, people outside of China used to say, you know, is this really real? Is it? I mean, surely, why are they building all those apartments? Why do these ghost cities exist? So people didn't understand fundamentally how it worked. So I said, think of you guys in the 90s, and that's what Saudi's doing now. It's opening up to the world. It has an ability to create a manufacturing base in the same way that China ended up having an advantage. China's case, it was low cost of labor and scale. Saudi's advantage, one very obvious advantage, is the cost of energy. So energy here is about 4 cents a kilowatt. You compare that to the US, or US is probably different states, Europe, compare it to Europe, it's probably like 30 cents a kilowatt. So if you're a manufacturer and you're heavy use of power, I mean, there's enough land, come and build a factory. There's a huge advantage on power. So as Saudi begins to build out the skills infrastructure that will support different industries, then this is going to be something that's going to happen within the next 10 to 20 years at a pace that will be even faster than China. So if you look at industrialization, it took the UK 200 years to industrialize. It took the US 100, and it took China 50. So Saudi can do it in 25. It's sort of like Moore's law. It keeps halving. And so I think that's the next 10 to 15 years is going to be about companies coming in to set up manufacturing here in sectors like renewables as an obvious advantage. I mean, the cost of power for data centers is the predominant cost. So with this energy advantage, you're going to get data center infrastructure being built here, which should be available to process computation, not just for Saudi companies, but potentially that's an outsourced opportunity to the world. So yeah, tourism is an exciting sector, but manufacturing's exceptionally exciting. The industrialization is something I think is going to be incredible.
I wonder how that would shift sort of global nexus of power. And anyway, this is a discussion that we're having in banking and finance as well. So if we look at technology historically also follows patterns of globalization and then regionalization. So we went through this era of having very global open technology, and then now we're seeing also more regional fit solutions. So one thing that we talk about in fintech is, you know, your solution has to be tailored to the Saudi market, to the GCC market.
Yeah.
What do you think about this global versus regional tech?
There is possibly a bifurcation happening from a geopolitical point of view. But there's no inhibition, no inhibitors to the development of Saudi and technology that needs to consider that the choices that you may be forced to make in the future, we don't know about. I think that if you think about some of the uncertainties, there's no question that supply chain certainty becomes much more a local and a regional issue if there's a fragmentation that takes place. And it came about not just because of geopolitics, but I think COVID perhaps changed the world as well. Suddenly people lost their supply chains, like instantly. So the right shoring of supply chains has become a feature of the global economy. People have talked about China plus one, or now they're talking about US plus one, because suddenly if you can't get access to the Chinese manufacturing supply, you need somewhere else just as a backup plan. So yeah, there's some focus on regionalization. I think that's right. That trend will probably continue.
You know, you highlighted it's a period of uncertainty, not just in terms of, you know, geopolitics, but the pace of technological advancement that's happening is extremely rapid. We also have an extremely young population here in Saudi, I mean, globally as well. If we're looking at the youth of today and how they should think about their career.
Yeah.
How would you look at it, you know, if you had to start over again today?
Well, my own kids said, look, Dad, it was easy in 2015. Just buy a Bitcoin. You don't have to worry. I, of course, had no idea about Bitcoin in 15, but they turned out to be right. Technology's become a key feature of banking. There are other areas that are still traditional and will remain, because banking is a very diverse industry, where if you have a degree in marketing, there's a job in banking. If you have a degree in arts, which is, you think would have nothing to do with banking, but you know, some of our best relationship managers have left side brains rather than right side brains. They're not mathematicians. They're very nice people and the customers like them. But technology is a key area. I mean, if you're a Python coder or a data scientist, those roles are much more in demand in banking than they ever used to be. If you have an understanding of how to use AI, again, the demand for those jobs has gone up a lot. So I would say career advice early on, you know, it's always the same within a large institution, banking or otherwise. For your own career development, you have to know where you're going. So you have to be clear. Mm-hmm. People like clarity. They don't like people if you say, well, you know, so what job do you think you might do in 3 years' time? Oh, I don't know. Just one that pays a lot of money. That's not a good answer. So have a focus and then connect to a network of support, both peers and people above you. But yeah, in terms of the specific areas of growth within banking, technology's got to be the focus at the moment for people coming into banking. I mean, we advertised for 20 IT graduates 2 years ago, and we, as an incentive to bring them in, it came with an MIT program, where we'd bring them in, they get access to MIT University in certain areas. And it was 20 roles, and we got 20,000 applicants. I mean, it was just phenomenal. And what was even better was half of the graduates we brought in were for young ladies who just come out of university with degrees in data science, AI, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's just quite amazing. So. Yeah.
There's an element of technology being democratizing in the sense that, you know, people who didn't before have opportunities to learn and to apply for these kinds of positions now can, but that also creates intense competition.
20,000.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, that's incredible for you guys to have, you know, the richness of choice, but then very tough for people who are in this market today. What would you advise on how to stand out?
It's interesting. I've been involved in a number of programs where you use AI to select candidates, which could end up in a dangerous closed loop.
Yeah.
So it's still about people. I mean, for interviews, the connectivity that happens between an interviewer and a candidate normally gets settled in the first 2 minutes. So for anyone applying for jobs who's going to go into an interview, you know, practice intensely on what you think you might be asked and what the right answer should be, and then go into the interview knowing that you're not going to get the job, which means your whole stress levels start to go down. You just go, well, I'm just going to try. And if you kind of look relaxed and confident, you're probably more likely to connect to the person who's interviewing. Obviously, if you look nervous and stressed and, you know, freaking out, it's a lot harder. So, but it is tough. I mean, you know, when I entered the industry in 1983, it was, no one asked for your degree. No one, you know, it was just, kid, you reckon you can do the job? Yeah, I think so. Why do you think you can do the job? Well, I used to work in a pub and I used to kind of be able to handle 5 orders at once. So I figure if people are shouting at me to buy and sell things, it's just the same. Okay, you're hired. Yeah, it was amazing. Now it's you need to top your class at Harvard or, you know, it is hard. But at the end of the day, it's still about people. And if you you know, if you don't necessarily have the top grade, it doesn't mean you can't get the job. It's still about people.
Wise words. To wrap up, I think just to close the loop on, you know, we've been talking about financial innovation this whole time. What do you think is the most exciting impact that financial innovation can have in the kingdom or globally in the next couple of years?
So financial innovation is bringing about automation, which, as I said before, it frees people up to think. So they're no longer, think being a teller in a bank. Not that exciting, really, when you think about it. But we still have tellers. You still have people. But they're now freed up to talk to customers as opposed to just, I want $100 and here's the cash and that's the end of it. Now you've got people sitting down with customers, you know, building relationships, finding solutions. So it makes banking more exciting as a career opportunity, that automation that is happening in the system. It has been happening for 20 years. I mean, the size of bank branches, the number of branches, we know globally that's all typically been going down. So I think it provides a more exciting career, that innovation. Obviously, for customers, it provides much better service. We all do our banking on our phones now, you know. So you don't have to walk to a branch. You don't have to worry about cutoff times. You know, if I've got, you know, a relative somewhere in the world who's suddenly asked me for money, which they do frequently because I'm an overpaid banker, I can send the money instantly. Thanks. Or my kids, if they're studying at universities or whatever, overseas. Dad, I need fees. Fees need to be paid today. Can you send me $100 so they can go to the pub in London? So it's much better service for customers, much easier. But I think importantly for staff, I know our staff here, the fact that we've built an innovation center, the fact that we're in a new building and we're investing, we're growing profits. Yeah, I know our staff like coming to work and being in the building because they've got time to collaborate. Whereas before it was like banking, you know, 30 years ago it was like
very cutthroat,
like a factory. It was like everyone just sat down and, you know, did this 8 hours a day and that was it. So it's exciting.
As a CEO then, reflecting on that, I mean, you are looking after how many hundreds of people here?
4,000.
Okay, 4,000 people. That must be a tough job.
Yeah, it's, I mean, being a CEO is, I first imagined becoming a CEO, ironically, when I was coaching a couple of rugby teams. I know I'm Australian, sports fanatic. And it was taking a team that actually wasn't performing very well and finding a way to coach them into believing in themselves and winning and beating the competition. When I thought about the attributes and elements behind that for sporting teams, not just the one I was coaching, but famous examples of great sporting teams, I started thinking, well, maybe CEO should kind of be like that, you know, rather than being disciplinarians or sort of risk averse. You know, many CEOs I'd worked with, they're always terrified of the mistakes people would make and what the regulator would think. So I started thinking about how to build cultures within the financial sector that created ambition and innovation and a mindset of winning. And I've been doing it now for 15 years and it seems to work. So I actually enjoy my job a lot because I enjoy people. I enjoy working with people. I enjoy seeing people succeed.
Being a coach.
Not because I'm telling them what to do, because I've helped them build their own confidence. And of course, they have the technical skills like any great football player, technically very strong, but how do they fit into the team? And how does the team together succeed? Because that's the only way this works.
Right. Business is a team sport.
100%.
Well, thank you so much for your time today.
Welcome.
It's been lovely.
Absolute pleasure.